Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today we're going to recap one of the contentious debates of the last year through three of the voices involved in it. Now you may remember back in October, City Council heard information on underutilized real estate assets owned by the City of Guelph. One of those assets is a parcel of land at 106 Beaumont Crescent, which was bought in the 1970s for the realignment of City View Drive, but that project never came to pass, and it no longer exists on the city's work plan. So what to do with it? A couple of councillors proposed using the land for modular homes that could then serve as supportive housing and fill a desperate need in our community. And that's where the fun begins. Testing the limits of housing is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, at the Committee of the Whole meeting on November 4th, Ward 2 Councillor Rodrigo Guller proposed a motion that staff be directed to investigate options and required needs for harm reduction housing at 106 Beaumont and report back by January 2020. Ward 1 Councillor Dan Gibson warned that looking at one specific site, even if the motion is just a request for information, might send a message that supportive housing was going to be built at 106 Beaumont. It would be a done deal, in other words. That was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy because, sure enough, people in the area of 106 Beaumont started to feel like modular homes were coming to their street on short notice and reacted accordingly. With that, a well-meaning motion to look at one possible way to get fewer people off the streets and into more sustainable homes became a lightning rod issue that sent people to the respective corners. Those in favor thought the negative reaction was overblown and NIMBY by its nature, while further stigmatizing the homeless and people suffering from addiction issues. In the other corner, you had people feeling like the city was moving fast on a proposal that would change the character of their neighborhood and without much local input, while at the same time overlooking the key question of whether the people who were meant to be helped by the modular housing at this location would be best served by the location. So what's the deal here? Well, consider it a test case. The city's being pushed more and more to take action on social and affordable housing, as well as supportive housing for people with issues beyond homelessness. In fact, Mayor Cam Guthrie's Task Force on Homelessness is being brought together to tackle this very subject. How will the city react to those proposals? Will people stand in the way of progress? Can the city move at a speed some people want, while at the same time doing all the due diligence others are demanding? This week on the Guelph Politicast, we'll hear from three of the important voices from that debate, all collected from separate interviews done on recent episodes of Open Sources Guelph. First, we'll hear from Ward 2 Councillor Rodrigo Guller, who was the originator of the motion and has become a vocal advocate on Council for Action on Homelessness. Then we'll hear from Ward 1 Councillor Dan Gibson, who was the sole no vote on that original motion and worked closely with the people in the area of 106 Beaumont concerned about the proposal to put modular homes there. And finally, we will hear from Kate Nixon, Lily Bent, and Siegfried of Your Downtown Guelph Friends, who have worked closely with the people in need and took the vocal opposition to the motion rather personally. So let's hear this week's guests, who all appeared on Open Sources Guelph before the holidays. Let's start with you've had a bit of a time lately. We talked to Dan last week, who was on the other end of the motion you brought forward on getting some harm reduction housing built at 106 Beaumont. But you were the originator of that motion. It died an inauspicious death this Monday at City Council.
That was painful, yes.
That was painful, yeah. How are you feeling about that now? I mean, it seemed like a bit of a lark, but talk about, what your ideas behind bringing that motion forward.
Yeah, so I was actually speaking with Bob Bell from Ward 1, and he let me know that the Guelph Wellington Drug Strategy was coming forward, that they were looking at supportive housing to some sort of model to help people transition from, that we have that gap between homelessness and affordable housing, and it's quite a big gap, and we need to find ways to fill it. So that community group actually came to us in June. So it goes back to that time. And they said, we have this project. We want to build some harm reduction housing here in the city. And we're looking at possibly using shipping containers. So it's a twist on that tiny home revolution.
Yeah.
And then later in the fall, we had a report come to City Council on stranded assets. It presented maybe 8 or 10 city properties, most of them on the edge of the city, or that are not being used or are underused. They pointed at one of them, located at 106 Beaumont, that was, you know, on a bus route. It's a half-hour walk to downtown. And you know, Bob said, how about this site? Could we potentially use it as a place for harm reduction housing here in the city? And I thought, well, that would be something. Because,
sure,
I mean, it's really tough that we have this big problem of homelessness growing in Guelph, and it is the responsibility of Wellington County. They are our providers for social housing, but they're not building social housing, and we can talk more about that. I thought having this unused or underused piece of land, maybe we can use it for a project that would bring modular homes that mm-hmm. could be placed, that they could be removed at a later date, and it would help us address this this growing problem of homelessness here in the city on at least a temporary basis.
Right.
That original motion was brought at the time that the stranded asset report came forward. We had a few conversations about it around the horseshoe, and we decided that it would be better to wait until November 4th when a report from city staff on the harm reduction housing work that had been done came forward. So we set it down, and then we let everyone know on November 4th we're going to be bringing this motion forward to mm-hmm. use this unused piece of city-owned land. Mm-hmm. For harm reduction housing, and it was to explore, you know, what would it take to use this piece of land? Is it even possible? What kind of zoning would we need? Because it is completely new to Guelph and to other places in the province. We do not have a presence of shipping containers being used as modular homes.
Yeah.
So it would be a testing ground to see what it would take. And from our part, the idea was that we would just be the owners of the land, and we would lease it to a proponent, and then they would take charge of managing this, and then that would be, you know, potentially a coalition of the different organizations that provide shelter support here in the city. However, the way that the conversation went on November 4th, 12 councillors voted in support of exploring, and one councillor voted against it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the way that it was picked up by the media and the way that it was portrayed was that council had made a decision to place housing for addicts in that neighborhood.
Right. It seemed like it was, I expand on this in mm-hmm. my column for Guelph Today this week. This was a process story, and we didn't get the story right. I don't know if I take any blame. I'll take a blame on behalf of the media. But you know, there was a format here. There was a process that stuff comes forward in committee, and then it gets ratified at the end of the month. And a lot of people, perhaps understandably, living in the area, didn't get that part of the message that this wasn't a done deal.
Yeah, and you know what? Even if people understood that it wasn't a done deal, I think it is scary to think that something strange and unknown is going to be coming to your neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
especially when there is a big misconception about who are the people that are living in tents by the side of the river. And there's this malignment of people who are in the most desperate situations in our community, living rough outside.
Yeah.
So I think we need to do work to address that perception, because no matter where we look to create harm reduction housing in the city, I expect that we're going to have a similar response from the immediate community.
And that's the thing I was thinking a lot about was because of the stigma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that, you know, but one of the things I will say that I found persuasive in at least one of the persons who delegated, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he's the one who pointed out that his area in Beaumont, that 106 Beaumont, although it is city-owned land, not necessarily earmarked for parkland or open space or something like that, that is essentially the only open park space in their neighborhood for the kids to enjoy, for the kids to just run around in and have fun in the outdoors. It's an underserviced area for amenities, and I think that angle of that concern was probably very legitimate.
Absolutely. That is indeed one of the more underserved areas of the community. And at the time when we had this report, I should have, but I didn't take the moment to consider who the neighbors were. We just thought we have one piece of land that staff is telling us could potentially be suitable for this.
Yeah.
So let's see if it could. But then we got entangled in the process. So now we, after long debates, and there were good arguments on both sides. So the community members who came, who advocated, I think you might have been speaking about Brian McPherson.
That's it.
Yep. He's a really good community advocate. He presented a really well-balanced argument. There were two young individuals who delegated on the other side, speaking about the plight of people who are sleeping rough in our city, Lily and Kennery.
Yeah.
And they spoke about their experience and really presented the fact that someone that is living rough is not going to be more likely to victimize other people. On the contrary, they're more likely to themselves be victimized.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that we need to recognize. And we need to have a little more compassion in our community. Now, of course, that's easy to say, but
yeah.
You know, if it was in my backyard, I understand that it would be different.
Yeah.
So we need to address the stigma. Now, thankfully, there are a lot of organizations in our community. I mean, we have Habitat for Humanity, the Drop-In Center, Hope House, the Guelph Community Health Center, and all of those organizations, they actually got together back in September for an affordable housing symposium. They had a couple of days of conversations, and they had a follow-up that was last week or the week before. And on the follow-up, they started identifying, you know, we need a leadership team. Mm-hmm. So we know we have this gap in our community, but it goes back to the same issue that we were having, is who is the proponent? Who is the person that's actually going to sign the dotted line and say, I take responsibility for this building. I'm going to be the one that looks for the grants. And, I mean, as a municipality, the city of Guelph is not in a position to do that.
Right.
We don't have the expertise, the skills to manage that sort of operation. Wellington County may, but then this is where it gets interesting. The mandatory, we give the county, I think, something in the realm of $22.5 million for housing, for disability supports, for childcare.
Yeah.
So we give that money to them. And then we saw when they presented their budget, each year Wellington County puts $500,000 towards affordable housing, towards building new affordable housing. So we are paying to maintain the existing housing stock here in Guelph, but we are not contributing anything towards a fund. I shouldn't say anything.
Yeah.
We put away, I think, $300,000 last year, and we have in the budget $330,000 again this year. But that is a very small amount compared to the number of people who are either underhoused or outright homeless here in Guelph. So I think we need to step that up.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets challenging because people say, well, it is a provincial responsibility to deal with housing, but the province is not coming forward to build housing here. So unless we put the money down, we're going to keep on having to pay more for police and the hospital and emergency services. So it's one of those challenges that, strictly speaking, mental health issues, poverty issues, housing issues, that is not within the direct responsibility of the city of Guelph, but all of the fallout from that, then we have to pay for it.
Right.
So I think this is one of those cases where if we spend some money and put some more resources towards supportive housing, harm reduction housing here in the city, we'll be saving a lot on emergency resources. I mean, I've heard that, you know, one individual that is in and out of hospitals and police and dealing with paramedics could cost the city upwards of $1 million. And that's just
for that one person.
For that one person. And that is a staggering amount. I mean, if we spent a fraction of that to house you know, a good number of people, then we would see a lot of savings on the back end. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that in this budget we can support the initiatives that came out of the mayor's task force looking at homelessness, and they are a court support worker that you know, works with people who are in the court system because of addictions, and helps them get out of that cycle of you know, offending, being released, maybe spending some time in the judicial system, in the penal system, and then coming out and having no supports.
Yeah.
So we want to support that. There's also the support recovery rooms, somewhere that gives people a couple of days in a stable place so they can think about their life and, actually maybe seek some support if they're ready to make a change. And I think that there's also the Welcoming Streets Initiative. That is a person that walks around downtown talking to people that are having a hard time. And it really helps the business owners because then they're not the ones that have to deal with someone coming into their business and maybe, you know, being high or just having a rough time.
Right.
So all of these initiatives, I'm hoping that we can continue to support them. And on top of that, we did have the request for $600,000 from the Adrian Carter from the Wellington Guelph Drug Strategy towards some sort of harm reduction housing. Sure, we don't have a place, but I think if we set aside the money, then there is a chance that we can have something placed somewhere in the city before next winter.
Yeah. Maybe before we run out of time, you've been in city council for over a year now, or almost a full year. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you're more knowledgeable now about the city matters? Do you feel that you've learned a lot? Has the year changed you?
Absolutely. I have learned a lot. I've learned about, I'm still learning about the importance of due process and how the slow wheels of the municipal government move and how to make effect. I'm also learning how to answer the questions that I want to answer when I get asked questions. So that is important. And I think there's still a long way to go. But what I really enjoy most about the job is talking to my constituents and helping them figure out issues, get answers to the questions that they have. So I am really enjoying the work. Weeks like this, when we have to deal with budgets,
right,
and when we have to deal with those tough issues, like what do we do to support the problem of people not having anywhere to live in Guelph? These are challenging weeks, especially when the balance of council that, you know, before voted to approve an exploration, you know, can we do this in this site? Then it flips around, and some of my council colleagues that I thought, oh no, these folks are really, they really care about the community, they really care about those who are most vulnerable in the community, they do a switch. And then, you know, the resolution that was passed instead of the exploration of this particular site, it was essentially a do nothing motion that was brought forward. That really flabbergasted me. You know, there was so much buildup from during that night about the motion that was going to be brought forward, but it was like, let's sit and wait. So I'm hoping that at least if we can put some money aside to support these projects, then we can have something tangible to give the community organizations when they come back with a proponent saying, okay, now we're ready to get this project going.
There are a lot of young people who are fairly passionate about that, you know, so what's your message to them going forward in terms of, you know, what council can do and maybe what you can do as the originator of that endeavor?
Yeah, no, I do want to connect with the individuals that came to speak because they have more experience than I do with these issues. And I think speaking up is incredibly important. Council can only do what we do with the information that we have. And when we don't have information, when we don't understand what the circumstances are of some of our community members, then I think that's part of why the city of Guelph hasn't been putting money away for supporting people that are living rough, because we just didn't know. So I think the more vocal and the more visible that people can be in a respectful way and in a way to build dialogue, it is very, very helpful. So I would encourage other people to come speak to your counselors, come delegated council meetings, and just overall help share the message and really help demystify this idea of ours versus them and help build some more warmth and tolerance towards the most vulnerable members of our community.
All right, well, that's a good place to leave it on. I want to start just by going macro.
Sure.
Which is, I think there's a visceral feeling that comes from, this is a file that has not been well examined the last several years, that we've been waiting for higher levels of government to act, we've been waiting to see, take from their direction. So maybe this is where the emotions, at least for one half of this comes so high, is that finally we have council saying, we're going to do it for ourselves. We're going to, you know, if the province comes on board, great. If the feds come on board, great. But, you know, how do you feel given that your role as counselor and, you know, how long has something like a project like this has come along?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on today, Adam. I really appreciate it. I enjoy your coverage of City Hall and this program for that matter. Long time listener. Third time guest.
Fourth, if you count the election.
That's right, actually. So, yeah, very good.
All right.
Almost a generational problem we have on this file, and I think the mayor said it best probably a year and a half ago, where he said, you know, it's time for everyone to sort of get together, get unified around tackling chronic homelessness in our city. And stop waiting, or stop saying it's someone else's problem. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a general spirit in Guelph to move the ball forward on this. It's something that has been lacking, the creation and development of rent geared to income or social housing in our city has been something that's really gone stale for the last few decades. And it's something that this council, I think, is unified on changing.
Mm-hmm.
How that looks, where it goes, who it services are, unfortunately, big questions, and those are questions that aren't quick fixes. However, I think it's undeniable that there's an appetite on council. You know, with the mayor's task force for targeting homelessness last year, I think we achieved 3 out of the 4 objectives.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth objective being that harm reduction housing is something that this is on our council agenda right now. It's on our plate.
Mm-hmm. To get to this specific motion that Councillor Gawler made,
mm-hmm.
it was you who said that, and you repeated this at the meeting on Thursday night, that council put a finger on a spot in the map, people are going to think it's a done deal. And I'm wondering if you think that was maybe self-fulfilling prophecy. you called it, and I think people took, you know, your cue, and maybe didn't, like, understand, you know, where you were coming from on that, but it's the understanding was made that
right.
Council had put their finger on the map.
So, council had. So this property came out of a surplus asset sort of report that came to council. It was a property that, through direction of council, can be investigated, can be sold or leased quite quickly, And quite frankly, the mayor said correctly, we have rules in our procedural bylaw that allow us to fast track these types of procedures. So I will admit the day after the motion being somewhat of a surprise to me and definitely a surprise to the public. There was no notification,
mm-hmm.
No public awareness on the issue at all. Emotions were running high that evening following the vote that I knew that people would be waking up the next day wondering what had happened and where this came from. So, yes, it was a little bit of straight talk from me, a little bit of plain talk. But, you know, I didn't take it back because it was a 12-1 vote. Mm. And
You were the one for the record. Yeah.
Me being the dissenter, I really needed to stake out my position as to why I took that stand. And we know the easy narrative in this city would be to say Dan's anti-homelessness or Dan's against this or against this. And quite frankly... I knew that narrative would get struck.
Yeah.
And I needed to make sure, and I needed to make sure that my territory on the issue was straight and clear, that we have processes for addressing these types of things. We have processes for advancing. We have decision-making processes that give the due process to the public,
right,
when they are hearing these news and they are being consulted on and engaged. And I felt like this gained so much steam and so much momentum in one meeting,
mm-hmm,
without ever being able to consult my constituents, that I needed to stake that territory up quickly. Being in the political world we are in, sometimes you're not always given the benefit of the doubt.
Sure.
And so I needed to stake that territory up properly before the narratives began.
Well, for the record then, would you feel as passionate about it if this was in the West End or in the South End, if there's this big parcel of land and Councillor Guller said, let's put the finger on the map there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been accused of NIMBYism before. I've been accused of NIMBYism on this file as well. But I'll say this, you know, the constituents weren't even given the opportunity to become NIMBYs because it was being moved so quickly. So there was no opportunity for them to really voice their concerns or even really ask many questions. It felt like the decision was two steps down the road.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I mean, it's a criticism that I've received around council before, that I am a process guy. So if you go back and look at the way the plastic bag motion, the plastic bag ban motion came forward a few years ago, I did not stand in front of it simply because I didn't support a reduction of plastics in our community. I stood in front of it because of the way it came forward,
mm-hmm,
and the way it was brought through a presentation to council, a late addition to the agenda, and then a surprise motion came out of it. So I like to think that if it was a motion that sort of came through a different channel, then I would oppose to it. And I always bring people back to this. I led a very public process on looking into whether or not we want to give homeowners a break on their driveways.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that through about a year and a half of public debate, of public back and forth, of interaction with staff and engagement with the public before we landed on a short-term and still a short-term solution.
Mm.
So I think my track record speaks for itself, that I am a process-oriented decision maker, and I think that the public deserves that as well.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if this is where process rubs up against, you know, expediency.
Sure.
That, you know, and I think you would agree that there are, everyone on council is well-meaning, and
I think in this file specifically, everyone's well-intentioned. Yeah,
right. And there's a desire to do things, and yeah, there is also the desire to get the good press from doing good things as well. But is you know, we're talking about homelessness. We're talking about, again, a file that, you know, we've had to literally blow the dust off of,
right,
in order to get any action on. And I think people see the action and not necessarily, and maybe this has to do with some of the mysticisms of City Hall too when it comes to the process. People, mm-hmm, know what action is. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily see process as action.
Right. So glacial speed, right?
Yeah.
So one of my very proud files that still is working to its way towards fruition is the Emico property.
Yeah.
So there's two ways to achieve this, and you made it quite right. A lot of the times, you know, we counselors and we want the public to know we're working on things, but we definitely do not want to make short-sighted and quick decisions that result in long-term mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And that is unfortunately part of the process here at City Hall, that we measure twice and cut once. We just do. Sometimes we measure 3, 4, 5 times and cut once. And but we'd like to think that when we make that decision, it's done with due process and with transparency.
Yeah.
On the Emico file, very similar. I would love to see that sod turning and that dirt turning today.
Right.
But there are processes that takes place, planning that has to take place before we can get that thing moving. I mean, I've talked ad nauseum on the project about where we're at. We're looking for the record of site condition with the Minister of Environment, Conservation and Parks. That is related to the contaminants in the soil.
Yeah.
We need to somehow extract those, dig them up, take them off site, or go through a risk assessment to get that site developed. That takes time, but my desire and my plan and my hope is that when we do start turning sod there, it will be for real outcomes that will have long-term lasting 100-year impacts on the community. The decision around Beaumont, it wasn't a decision, it was a motion of council that was passed.
Yeah.
It still needs to be ratified,
yeah.
Which I'm hopeful that there's some amendments coming. Was not only quick and rushed, but we hadn't talked about, you know, what about services? What about bringing in? What about development charges? How do we bring in water and sewer? How do we bring in hydro? Is the site appropriate? You know, is the site appropriate for the citizens that we're looking to support there? It is harm reduction housing after all.
Mm-hmm.
It's not social housing. It's not rent geared to income housing. These, how it was described to me was harm reduction housing. These are individuals that need a lot of support.
Yeah.
And is that in that sort of context, is Beaumont the best place for them, being that it's on the outskirts of town, being that it's going to need 24-hour supervision and supports? Those are all questions that we need to ask. We weren't granted that kind of time,
right?
Last week.
Then I wonder. Then, I mean, there are so many questions, as you said. You know, I wonder. Maybe we can address this first. The nature of the project, harm reduction,
sure,
housing. There's an immediate visceral reaction from people about, you know, who that is going to be for, and for basically people who are drug users, recovering drug users. And I'm wondering, no matter where this goes in the city, isn't there going to be this reaction? I mean, no matter where the proposal is, no matter how long it takes, there's going to be this reaction, immediate, visceral, even angry.
I think you're, what you're responding to is what you're seeing or observing.
Mm.
And again, I said this very clearly at the town hall last week. You know, full disclosure, one of the biggest reasons why I didn't actually formally invite the media to the town hall is because I knew some people needed to vent. Some people needed to have,
yes,
a free and open space to sort of say how they were feeling, even if it was wrong,
mm-hmm,
or if it was misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want those quotes or those comments being attached to that person indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
Quite frankly, I've said this to many counselors, we should have expected that response. The way we brought the decision forward, we were inviting that kind of knee-jerk response from the public. So that being said, when a decision is made and how we move forward with it, there are ways in which you can incorporate these types of harm reduction housing into your community where it's not a big hotspot in your city. You can small developments here, there, but the most important thing that I'm learning in speaking with the folks over at the Public Health Center is they do need to have close proximity to the services they require.
Yeah.
And that does not necessarily mean a trailer on site,
mm-hmm,
with the counselor working, you know, 9 to 5. We need 24-hour supports, wraparound coverage, access to healthcare professionals on a daily basis. And in those cases, most of the time you're talking about being close to downtown,
mm-hmm,
being closer to downtown,
mm-hmm,
simply because those are where the services are accessed.
Yeah.
So I don't have a site, I don't have a location. I have explored the idea of warming shelters or temporary warming shelters through the wintertime, especially in the wintertime when it's cold out in local municipal parking lots, and whether or not we can bring in sort of 4 or 5 bedroom portables,
mm-hmm,
with sort of perhaps not plumbed but safe individual bedrooms that can be locked so individuals can have their space, they can feel comfortable, and we can sort of meet that immediate need because of the cold weather. Those are still things that I'm having a back and forth with staff on. What's the permitting allowance or what's the permitting,
yeah,
process to get those things going?
I think one of the things that came out of the town hall that I found interesting was that, yes, there was tremendous passion, but I mean, everybody had sort of a different perspectives. I mean, yes, there were the people who were very NIMBY, as you said. People,
mm-hmm,
were like, you know, the wrong place, wrong time, I can't let my kids outside. There were the people who were like, we are for something like this, but we don't like the process. There are people who are like, yes, there are people who need help, but is it, you know, is this the right way? And then there was the one gentleman who was talking about how, you know, there are people committing crimes, ransacking backyards, and trying to frame the homeless people, and it's just,
so that
like,
was an interesting comment.
Yeah, it's this big ball of rubber bands that it's hard to pull one out, and, you know. But you're the one who has to make the decisions.
Yeah. Welcome to life as a city councilor.
Yeah.
So I hope if anyone's listening and who came or would have liked to have come, I want to say again what I reiterated there, that there was a very wide spectrum of opinions.
Yeah.
There was a group at the front door that had some signs that were sort of, I think they made some assumptions about what the meeting was going to look like.
Yes.
And how it was going to sound. And I'm really pleased that they stuck around and stayed and listened to the concerns, listened to my comments, because I think there may have been some prejudgments around what I was going to say.
Mm.
So I really appreciated the dialogue from all members of the community. I think at the end of the day, the only common denominator that you could really find was that there was a genuine concern and compassion for helping people. How that looked, where it went, all those things are bigger questions, but I think our intent and our motives are in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, we can move forward. Now, so when it comes to the people who are living in the encampments in the East End, I think there's 8 right now. Mm-hmm. I've actually got a constituent who's kind of mapped these locations for bylaw for the police, because there is concern. The question is, will this harm reduction housing be targeting those individuals? Like, will that encourage them to come in? Because we know when we speak to individual cases that many of those individuals are choosing not to come to the shelters,
right,
for whatever reason. Their OW case numbers, they're identified individuals, we know who they are, but they simply don't want to come into the shelter system for whatever reason. They don't feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
One gentleman has a dog. I'm not going to talk about individual cases, but how do we encourage them to come in to our care or come in and get support? And then hopefully you alleviate some of those pressures that are occurring in our suburban neighborhoods where, as I mentioned last week, you know, propane tanks are going missing this time of year because people are looking for heat. Those are all those things that, you know, you've got two sort of a suburban and an encampment world kind of colliding, and it's not going well.
You said you're a process guy. I think it's fair to say, and by all means correct me if I'm wrong, but you are a small C conservative guy. You
label me today.
Well, I mean, watching council for several years, sure, you get a feel for people, but this seems to me like the perfect classic example of too much regulation. That if something that's keeping somebody out of a shelter is that they've got a dog.
That's a great question for social services. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's in everyone's best interest, quite frankly, to have city councilors that are fiscally minded, quite frankly. We are not allowed to run deficits at the municipal level.
Mm-hmm.
So having someone who's got a fiscal conservative bent to them is not necessarily a bad thing. It may in fact be a blessing in disguise for councils who are, quite frankly, whatever you spend, you have to tax. There's sure, no ability for us to run deficits operationally at the municipal level. So sure, whatever anyone tries to label me, I say sure. You know,
yeah,
label me what you want. But from a social perspective, I think Guelph's social conscience speaks for itself. I think we're all unified in trying to help people. We don't want to leave members of our community behind. That being said, how we approach that, you know, there's a paternal approach, there's a loving approach, there's a caring approach.
Mm.
We do have to encourage those individuals to come in to the shelters if it means trying to accommodate someone because of their dog or their, you know, their man's best friend or woman's best friend.
Yeah.
Then we should try and see what we can do. But at the end of the day, I think we all need to make a decision that living rough, camping rough, is not sustainable,
right,
for our community, and we need to reach out and either have conversations or start informing them that we need them to be in shelter.
I heard Tina Bromfey say that camping is something you do when you have money. So to her point, though, it just strikes me that the way we think about this is like, we'll build houses and we'll put people in them. We'll put everybody into a van and we'll drive them to a shelter. And it's not as easy as that.
No. Trust me, there's a depressing side of me that is scared that we will always have some people living rough.
Yeah.
Because they've chosen that path and there's not much we can do to bring them in. The issue that I have with it is when it's for reasons other than just a straight personal choice.
Mm.
If there are addictions or mental health issues associated with living rough, we need to try and work on those individual cases, because quite frankly, when there's criminality associated with living rough, then you're victimizing neighborhoods that otherwise shouldn't be victimized. You're having break-ins. I promised not to tell these stories last week simply because I did not want to paint individuals living rough as all criminals. That's
right.
By no means what I'm saying. But I, as a counselor, I do get lots of stories. I get calls once a week about stories about regular neighborhood families being victimized by individuals, whether, and that, again, I'm not putting blame to who they are, but maybe I'll stop there because I don't think it's fair to keep going.
No, and it's also, as some people at the meeting were talking about, that it's people who know where the homeless people are and can know that that's where the blame will fall. And
right. So there are some elements of organized crime happening, especially in the east end of the city,
sure,
around some of the businesses on Elizabeth Street, where it is quite organized. It doesn't look desperate. It looks like it's planned, and I know I'm reporting all that to the police, and there's lots of cases of that. So yes, I know for a fact that some of the live rough sites are resulting in some petty crime.
Yeah.
But by no means is it a black and white issue or a one and a zero issue.
In studio, we are joined by Siegfried, Lily Brunt, and Kate Nixon, who are among your downtown Guelph friends. So thanks for coming in, guys. Why don't we just start by talking a little bit about your group and who you are and what you're trying to accomplish?
So essentially, we are a group of like-minded people that sort of envision how the poverty scene and the marginalized community in Guelph, sort of how we could help, and we all have the same vision. We all come from different organizations, different backgrounds, sort of different like levels of education, but we all have the same like mindset. And basically our role in the downtown community is to play a friend role to marginalized folks in the downtown core, while also trying to support other people who are doing similar initiatives to us, and also trying to fill in gaps within the community that we see.
So talk a little bit about that gaps. I mean, what were you seeing that maybe wasn't getting done helping people out, helping out the marginalized, that you've said to yourselves, we have to step up? You know, what is kind of driving your work?
Definitely something that we all felt really strongly about was the lack of a warming center in Guelph.
Mm-hmm.
That has recently come into effect within the past few days, actually. That's going to be set in place on Friday, so tomorrow. But that was something that we were really like strongly for this winter, because last winter we were very much like seeing a crisis in the downtown core with people not having anywhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that we've actually been able to really advocate for a year now, and happily it's had a good result. But also something else is we see that there is lack of dinners on certain nights of the week, so people aren't having access to three meals a day, which I think is something that we can all really take for granted. So that's something that we're trying to fill right now. Sunday nights is probably the worst night for people, so we're in the midst of trying to fill that gap right now.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that, you know, maybe politically we're kind of in a moment where we're seeing more discussion about homelessness issues, poverty issues in city council. And, you know, how are you guys feeling about that from the other end? Because, you know, you guys are doing your thing, which is great. But at the same time, there is levels of responsibility, and it's not just on you guys who are, you know, trying to do your own thing with whatever resources you can scramble, but there is an actual government response that's mandated too. You know, how are we feeling about that these days?
And a lot of what we see is just that discussion. It's been talked about over and over again, doing things, but then every time we see city council, they're just pushing it off further and further, but they pat themselves on the back for having the conversation, while people out here, like, none of us have the luxury of being paid to do this, but we put in a lot of time and a lot of our own funds, and, like, you know, you think council, being paid to do their job, would be able to think a little deeper into how community members are sacrificing their own financial well-being and time to help out in this gap that we're seeing every day.
Right. Part of that, too, though, and I realize your frustration, because I think a lot of people share it, but, you know, there is the apparatuses of government, too, and, you know, there's a lot of finger-pointing, buck-passing. But there are sort of like multiple levels of responsibility, and you know, how do you guys sort of navigate the politics of this too when you're trying to advocate?
Yeah, so that's something we actually like. We've taken on that role as well. It's something that makes us different from other people that are sort of in the out of poverty community. Is sort of playing an advocacy role within the community. So we've been analyzing sort of how these conversations take place at City Hall, and how we can contribute to the conversation on the end of like out of poverty work, because oftentimes we are seeing that voice is not represented. It's frustrating for us. I'm not gonna lie. It's definitely a very frustrating process. We do see a lot of times that the blame, I guess, is being shifted all the time. And I know, like a year ago, January, Mayor Cam Guthrie was saying that he has dropped the ball on this for the past 3 years, and that this was urgent. But then here we are 3 years later, and we sort of really haven't moved in any different direction in terms of the city. And it's just really, like, I think a lot of times it's a lot of empty words behind the city. It's a lot of promises to do better and never any action behind that.
To Cam's credit, he did a Facebook town hall last night where he did say he was behind. He came to this late. I think that was an exact quote, that he came to this late. These things do compound, though. I mean, it's been 20 years since social housing was downloaded on the province. It's hard to turn a ship around in the middle of the ocean and, you know, on a hair turn, right? And do you think that maybe, I don't know, it seems like one of these issues where I like you, you know, share that kind of lack of patience. You know, we should have been dealing with this 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how can we move quicker, do you think? You know, because it's not just a matter of the political will, because I do think the political will is there. But it's also a matter of, as we said, the multiple levels of government, multiple agencies involved. It's that big ship that you can't turn around quickly enough.
Well, there's a lot of things we can do immediately, like implementing harm reduction instead of giving police in this city more funding, which will only make things 10 times worse on the people we're trying to help. We have council members, including the mayor, with several developer donors that have large empty spaces that could offer warming centers. They just decide not to. So...
Well, I mean, that gets into something, too, that I've heard it said that the city has enough shelter beds to cover the needs, but it is there is difficulty in getting people into shelter. Some people don't feel safe. Some people have pets who are not welcomed in the shelter. You know, there are a variety of concerns, but, you guys deal with the people who were trying to get people into shelters. And so, you know, from your experience, what's the delta that is sort of keeping people from getting the shelter space that's being offered?
So actually there is not enough beds. It's not enough beds for the amount of people that are requiring beds. They're putting people in motels at the moment. And that's been something that's been going on for months now. And there are also like a certain timeline as well, where like you get access to the shelter, and if you outstay that,
right,
you're forced kind of back on to the streets. And also if you miss the deadlines, so if you're 5 minutes late, for example, you're also put back onto the street. So that's sort of what we're seeing more so than people being reluctant, because in reality, nobody wants to be cold. And
right,
there are some factors as well that are definitely red tape for people, such as paraphernalia. Yes, there is pets. That is an element as well. But for the most part, I find the city just likes to sort of put blame on those people and say, well, they're not taking the help we're offering, when that's not the case, because we're not offering enough in my opinion, and people aren't being able to access the things that they need to be.
Right. When you say paraphernalia, you mean drug paraphernalia. Mm-hmm. So they may be users and...
Substance-dependent, yeah.
Substance-dependent, thank you, yes.
Which is a lot of the homeless community that we have. Substance abuse goes hand-in-hand with it quite often.
Right.
And we don't offer the type of help to be wanting every single person who's on the street to be in a bed sober. Because what's keeping you warm and moderately functioning on the street is often continuing your addictions.
Right. So. You raise an interesting point, because I think people forget this, too, that, what is it, you get 28 days... consecutive in the shelter, and then you can't go back for 3 months.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's a huge red tape.
Yeah.
For a bunch of people, because like, no, who can pull up housing in that amount of time? Like, with the amount, like with the red tape on housing too, it's really hard to find housing you can be eligible for, especially within such a small window of time. So that's definitely something we're seeing. Of course, we would like to see affordable housing being implemented in the city. But for now, we think there just needs to be adequate warming centers, which is in the process, and just more beds available for people.
So you guys work downtown with Ed Pickersgill of the mm-hmm. Bench, and you're mm-hmm. sort of, I guess, in tandem, but an offshoot of that. And I take it, are you there almost every day, or just is it just one day a week these days? You're there on and off, right?
We're there as often as we can be. Everybody else also has jobs and are students.
Of course,
so we're there as much as we possibly can to build these connections and help out.
Because I've noticed that from in talking to Ed, too, that there are certain people that appear a lot. And my question would be if we were able to and said, okay, let's build as much affordable housing as this town needs tomorrow for immediate need, mm-hmm. what would your estimate be in terms of the number of people? I mean, it obviously goes beyond the bench and beyond you folks being downtown, but is it would an apartment of 100 take care of it, or is it?
No, yeah, we'd say probably close to 500.
500
units, because if it's 130 changing number concert like.
Right, because the number by name
that they're
list,
saying
right?
that the 130 is our confirmed homeless people, but we know that it's a lot more than that, including people who couch surf, people who are home insecure, people who just won't admit to being homeless,
and the little patches in the woods around town, which is at least six that I know of, where there's at least two on the way here from the ward, so that's significant too. Wow, so it is that high.
So I mean, where's the disparagement though? You guys are saying one thing, the cities and the agencies are saying another thing. I don't think anyone's kind of being disingenuous about it, but it strikes me that there's really no hard facts about the extent of the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
That
it's a guess.
It's a guess.
It's like it could be 500, it could be 1,000. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a huge lack of transparency. So our numbers are different because we actually communicate with these people face-to-face.
Right. With all due respect for, like, the politicians in the city as well, I don't see any of them doing any groundwork with homeless folks. So I don't really feel that when they pull out sort of these examples and these scenarios that it's as legitimate as ground workers.
Mm. But, I mean, it goes to something Lily said, too, that, you know, couch surfers, people you don't typically think of homeless. And I think when Cam was describing the work of going into the by name list, he talked about, you know, workers, you know, finding people on the streets. And that fits a very tidy, very particular definition of homelessness that doesn't get into things like substance abuse or mental health or people who are, you know, just trying to find a place to stay tonight with one friend and then maybe going to another friend's house the next night. What do you think? How would this be better? If they were to invite you guys in and say, like, how can we, you know, get better data? How does that help, do you mm-hmm. think? What suggestions would you guys offer?
Definitely communication with other people that are in this field that are, like, Edward Pickersgill, for example. I think that the city needs to do a lot more communication with that guy. That guy knows the inside out about the street, people living in the downtown core by name and by scenario. He gets over like 300 visitors a week at the bench. So I think like communication with people like that, for instance, should be a priority. I think honestly, even getting better data, I would like to honestly see politicians come out onto the streets and learn about these people that they're talking about in their conversation.
Learn their names. Where they come from, make eye contact with them.
Yeah. a lot of you guys are young people. I know that you were invited to do the Breezy Breakfast that the Phil and James do every week, and you know, you guys were at the town hall Dan Gibson had last month regarding the supportive housing proposal for Beaumont. Do you feel like you're being heard? Do you feel like this people are engaging you, or are the people like maybe taking you for granted?
I think it's like a 50-50. That Breezy Breakfast thing, we got a lot of people who would like to be involved going forward. We have good connections with Rodrigo Galler now, mm-hmm. who is clearly progressive and would love for things to change in the same ways that we want.
James Gordon.
Yeah, Phil James Alt. Gordon, Phil Alt, but...
So you have allies, but it's not
yes, we have allies, but yes.
Better than where we started.
Right. So can you guys be a voice for the people you're talking about here for a minute? Because when you talk to them about what their needs are, what they would like to see, I think that, and you might agree, that those of us who are well-clothed, well-fed, well-homed, make certain assumptions about what people who are not any of those things might need in order to help them feel safe, in order to help them build a life for themselves. So when you talk to them and you ask them about their needs, what do they tell you?
Honestly, they never ask for anything that's unreasonable. Everybody likes to think that they ask for handouts, that they're asking for too much, but really they're asking for things that are really just basic human rights and basic things, you know, that like about dignity. For example, a lady said to me, she said, because she learned about sort of the work we were doing, and she said, it's going to sound better, like, it was just really sad because people should be able to voice what they're experiencing, but she said, it's going to sound better coming from you, but can you please tell the city that I would really like to have a washing machine that I don't have to pay part of my OW money for. She had nowhere to wash her clothes.
Right.
And that's something that I was like, wow, you know, like, that's so true. I didn't consider that before, right? Because we're so privileged that we right. don't have to think twice about that.
Yeah.
And there was that, and there was a guy who said, I have nowhere to put my belongings. He has to carry everything on his back
right.
all the time. And he's got nowhere safe to put his belongings. And then he said, if you leave something at a shelter locker for a few days, it's thrown into the garbage, and it's everything, like all of his belongings. And I'm thinking, wow, I can't imagine having to carry everything I own on my back every day.
Yeah.
It's just things like that. Of course, they you know, affordable housing, they always ask us if we could look around for anything that's within their range, which is really, really sad, too. But it's always things like that, just really basic human needs, really.
Sometimes they really just want someone to talk to who's not going to look in the opposite direction and pretend that they're somehow assaulting them for existing in the same space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The washing machine thing is so interesting because, I mean, when you think about... Yeah, you have to have access to one. There are coin, you know, laundries around, but you also have to have the coin. It also takes, like, the roll of loonies. You have to be able to go into a bank and get your roll of loonies. Or,
right.
And, yeah, just, you're right. It does make you think about your privilege.
Mm-hmm. It really does.
I wanted to ask you guys about the NIMBY factor, too. I mean, that came up, I think, pretty obviously when we were talking about the Beaumont. And that was just... Mm-hmm. One counselor saying, hey, why don't we look at this piece of land? And we've heard a lot about the concerns about those residents there. But it does strike me that, and again, I don't want to keep referring back to the town hall Cam did last night, but I mean, there were things said about people being concerned about the kids in their neighborhood, if there was supportive housing in their neighborhood, to be concerned about letting the kids out.
It was worse than that, honestly, dealing with the town hall.
Yeah.
They had issues with their autistic kids and disabled kids are somehow intellectually unable to take care of themselves.
Mm.
And that homeless people are these horrible, dangerous people.
Mm.
And it was said by several different people who thought that was okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's just part of... This is a battle on, like, so many fronts. One of them is just, like, getting people the help they need. The other part is destigmatizing everybody. Mm-hmm. And then it's almost like you can't do one without the other.
Mm-hmm.
You can't fight this battle one battle at a time.
Destigmatizing would be the first.
Yeah.
That we need to be able to make proper strides to help people.
And we were trying to do that with our presence at the town hall that Dan Gibson had, because we were monitoring the comments and the reaction of the community. And we were really disappointed. I thought Guelph was better than that. I'm not going to lie. I was really sad to see the things that people were saying. I saw everything from homeless people are going to kill the kids that live in the group home down the street,
right,
to autistic children aren't capable of taking care of themselves and a homeless person's going to kill them,
right,
or hurt them. And we actually have somebody that's in part of your Downtown Guelph Friends that was able to speak to that. And she said, I was homeless and I'm autistic and never once did anybody try to target me that was homeless. So she was able to speak to that. And sort of show people the other side to that, because oftentimes that narrative was being given a platform and being amplified. But we were really appalled by the comments.
Yeah.
And we showed up as sort of a counterpoint to those comments, because we knew that town hall was going to be very much a conversation around with those kinds of things being thrown around. So we showed up in support of our friends living in the downtown community,
right,
and living in marginalized. And I have to say, I was disappointed in Dan Gibson's response to our presence there.
He was not happy at all. He came out looking for me specifically, actually, because I was asking him questions on Facebook about, if this isn't a thing about, if this isn't about profit over profit over people's lives, if this isn't about villainizing people, then what is it about? And he wouldn't answer me at all, but he came out looking for me very angrily for us having signs that just say people over property.
Mm-hmm. And it's, that's almost the most severe example. One of the things that stuck out to me and still sticks out to me is about that meeting was that I can't remember who said, but it was someone who was with the friends who said, I wouldn't mind having this in my backyard.
Mel.
And somebody asked her where do you own land? And she's like, I don't own, I rent. And there were at least half a dozen people who snickered or harumphed.
Scoffed at them.
Yeah.
They would not have had a right answer to that no matter what they said. They would have laughed at them no matter what.
Right. But it speaks to a certain point of view. And by all means, it's not all people on this issue, but that, some people have rights, and those are the people who own land and are property owners and homeowners. Bless them. They able to achieve the dream. But, people just have a basic dream of having somewhere safe to sleep. And that's hard enough to achieve for some of those people.
Yeah, it was very disappointing. And when Mel shared that they would be very happy to have people on their property, and people scoffed at them when they shared that they rent the community. They're a student.
Yeah.
And it was almost like everyone in that room was sort of looking down on them and sort of just for renting property. And that was pretty disappointing too. And I was really shocked. I have to say, the behavior in that room for adults was certainly questionable and very sad on our end of things.
And once again, that was Ward 2 Councillor Rodrigo Galler, Ward 1 Councillor Dan Gibson, and Kate Nixon and Lily Bent and Siegfried of your Downtown Guelph Friends. Stay tuned to Guelph Politico for more about the housing debate here in Guelph and the push to get more social and supportive housing built, because there's going to be a lot of news on this subject in the year to come. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus, and to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from the host Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com, reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. You can also go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you could find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.